certainty is another characteristic of love. According to Rumi, you wouldn't find certainty in science and philosophy or philosophy. That is that is unattainable. Do not search or go to philosophy in order to find certainty, to become certain about something. I mean, if in the past this was not clear enough, I think nowadays, under the modern epistemologies, virtually everybody now is satisfied and to this particular conclusion, and everybody understand it and accept that philosophy is all suppositions upon suppositions, science is all theories upon theories, refutable and falsifiable theories, and disputable arguments in philosophy. There are different schools of philosophy, there are different various theories of science and so on. So, though for the sake and for the experience of life, we base our life on science, but we are pretty certain that there cannot be, we are only certain that there are no certainties. So this is only one certainty that we have got about science and philosophy. There are suppositions only. Now, should we despair from certainty? Rumi tells us, no, you can find certainty, but only in love. Because in love, you have got the unity between the knower and the known. And that's the way that you can find the real essence of things. But in science and philosophy, you use your mind in order to depict the reality. And that picture may or may not correspond with the fact. And because of the certainty, actually the courage, which I mentioned previously, stems from certainty. When you are not certain enough about something, you would not have the courage to take action. But when you are absolutely certain, then of course it gives you a courage that science or philosophy may not. So philosophers actually were not ready. I mean, look into the history. They're not ready to sacrifice themselves or to take big actions. Okay, because they were actually in bondage of their suppositions and unconsciousness and pride and everything. It was only for the lovers who had such an ability and such a capacity. So, of course, love, you cannot use it in order to know something about the world, in order to replace science with love or philosophy with love, but in supernatural matters, in the case of God, and in order to know Him, the best way is not to philosophize about Him. The best way to know God is to love Him. And through love, of course, you reach a certain knowledge about Him. That gives you eyes which you cannot find it elsewhere in any other school of thought. About certainty, Rumi tells us a lot in Masnavi and in his odes. And for example, he thinks that the difference between prophets and philosophers is that prophets are certain people. They have got the bounty of certainty, and that was why they were so courageous about their mission, about their message, and they were so influential in their societies. That was because of certainties. They were not philosophers in the ordinary sense of the word. They were not theologians. They were lovers, and the certainty and the courage of love actually made them prophets. So these are the main characteristics of prophets as well. In one of the verses in his odes, he says, one can learn 1,000 points in the school of love, that the school of reason would not teach you those points. So there are two different schools, school of love and a school of thought. And in each school you can learn a lot of lessons. And a lover, for that matter, is sometimes, even if you like, more knowledgeable. Though the knowledge of a lover is very different from the knowledge of a philosopher, in the sense that the philosopher is supposedly clear about what he thinks, and cautious, of course, and in bondage of supposition, that the lover is absolutely certain about what he knows, and the lover's knowledge actually makes him courageous and in order to take action, but the philosopher's not. Unity, as I mentioned before, is another characteristic of love or lovers. آفرین بر عشق کل استاد صد هزاران ذره را داد اتحاد. This is in Masnavi. He says, praise be unto the love. It is its business to unify things which are scattered. And that's why he says, if you look at theology or philosophy, prophets and religions are different from each other. But when you look at religions through the angle or the point of view of love, all these religions and prophets are one and the same. So love actually brings in unity with itself, but mind and thinking actually brings in the diversity. No unity through reason or rational faculty, and all unity through love and loverhood. This is the message or mission of Rumi. Now we come to the last point about love, and that's the religion of love. Now Rumi was a devout Muslim, as I said, and before he became a lover, he was a mufti, he was a theologian, he was a mufassir, a commentator of Quran and other things. Now, when he came to become familiar with the idea of love and to experience love in the under Shams, he learned something which he called it the religion of love. Let me explain this. There is a verse in Quran that says the main business of the prophets, فَمَا نُرْسَلُ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِلَّا مُبَشِّرِينَ وَمُنْذِرِينَ. There are two main things that all prophets are there for, in order to warn people or to give them good tidings. Okay, this is the main business of the prophets according to Quran. They either warn you of the punishment of God, of hell and things like that, or gives you good tidings if you are obedient to God and if you worship Him and you are an ethical person and so on and so forth. But this is the main business of prophets. But then Rumi says that the religion of love is different from the religion of prophets. He does not necessarily say and think that the religion of love contradicts the religion of prophets. But what he says originally is this, that religion of love is something that prophets did not want to preach it, because most of the people perhaps cannot carry it, cannot bear it, you see. So it was perhaps left to the mystics to teach people and to preach people the religion of love. In the religion of love, there is no mention of the fear or the punishment or even the rewards of God. There is nothing like that. A lover's reward is the love itself. He is so selfless that he doesn't bother and he doesn't think about the rewards or the punishments of God. This is the meaning of the religion of love. in the first book, in the book one of Masnavi, actually, he mentions that Mazhab al-Ashaq, Mazhab al-Hudas, the religion of a lover is different from the religion of all other religions. Ashaqan ra Mazhab al-Millat Khudas, the religion of lover is God and only God. So the difference does not mean necessarily the contradiction, but it means that for lovers, religion means something altogether different. Of course, this brings us to the idea of religion itself, which may be the subject of another session. But let me tell you very briefly that for Rumi, actually, religions are social things, and they do not much have to do with the heart of the people. They are just in order to manage the social affairs and among the people, especially the Sharia, according to Rumi. But when it comes to the heart, that is a different thing, and there actually the mystics and the contemplatives come in order to teach us how to rearrange our connections and relationship with God. In one of the most telling poems in Masnavi, he says that, let me read you first the Persian, "Van Ruzakhastan khane ko bi rozan ast, asladin ay khaje rozan kardan ast. A house without windows is nothing but a hell." Now, then he says, the essence of religion is to open windows, is windowing, if you like. Now, to open windows, asladin ay khaje rozan kardan ast. To open windows to whom? To God. So, a house without windows is a hell. So, in order to get rid of the hell, in order to turn the hell into heavens, if you like, you have to open windows to it. And that is the real essence and the real nature of religion. You might actually perform and observe all the Sharia go to Hajj, to Mecca, or go to church or whatever, without having any windows to your God. So that is no religion, according to Rumi. Therefore, in Rumi's sense, there are two different religions, a collective religion and a personal religion. Church, mosque, pilgrimage to Mecca, and collective prayers and so on, all these are collective religion, which has got sometimes nothing to do with the real religion. And then you have got an individual, personal religion, the window, the personal window that you open to the universe, to God, and so on. That is the essence of religion. And here, of course, love comes in. And in this particular sense, all religions become one and the same. So he was a pluralist, in the real sense of the word, a pluralist through love, and thanks to love. Theologians never can reconcile with each other. Their disputes and their debates are eternal, and they are always at war. This is their witness. This is the requirement of their profession. They cannot, their arguments and their ideas are never compatible. They cannot reconcile with each other. But lovers are one and the same. So his pluralism is based on love, on certainty, on selflessness, on courageousness, and so on and so forth. So this is my last point. He says that Nazargah has the maqz wujud ikhtilaf mu'min wa kafir yahudi. It is only because of the point of views that Jews and Muslims and Christians and Zoroastrians are different. When the point of view become one, that all these religions, you will see that they will become one. And that oneness and that single point of view from which you will see, all these diversities as unity, is the point of view of love. So this is the religion of love, and those are the characteristics of the lovers and the of loverhood. So let us pray at the end that perhaps God may bestow upon us some love and loverhood. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sarush, for your presentation. A couple of notes before question-answer. One, the handout that we passed around is from the book entitled The Sufi Path of Love. The author is William Chittick, and it was published by State University of New York Press in Albany in 1983. And the second note, for those of you who walked in late, we were originally planning on having lectures all the way until December 17th. But Dr. Sarush informed us that he will be leaving out of town at the end of November. So after this session, we have two sessions left, next week and the following week. So I just wanted to inform you guys. And then if possibly we have more sessions in the future, we'll let you know. And with that, I would like to open it up to question and answer.
Silence.
That is, again, one of the main characteristics of love. No wonder, no wonder.
I actually have one. Oh. You talked about certainty and the fact that it doesn't exist unless, you know, you become involved in the Sufi sort of love. But, I mean, certainty doesn't, you know...
Sorry, does exist.
It doesn't. It sounds like a rest tomorrow, you know that. And you don't have to be a Sufi to understand that.
Do you know that sun will rise tomorrow?
I do. You want to bet?
No, you are certain that you are... there are false certainties as well. I mean, especially the example that you give. This is one of the well-known examples among philosophers of science. In order to explain that induction does not work, they usually mention the same example. They say, though... sun has risen for millions of times. We are not certain at all that it will rise tomorrow as well. So no certainty. Now, from the point of view of religion as well, I mean, if you are a religious person, after all, this world will come to an end. And the last day means the day after, there would not be neither sun nor moon nor anything else. Therefore, we are not really certain that the sun will rise tomorrow. It is only an induction according to philosophers. I don't think that there is any philosopher who opposes that, who does not accept that an induction never creates or produces certainty. It is only a likeliness. Yes, it is very likely, you might say, very likely. But it doesn't mean that it is 100% sure that the sun will rise, nor for that matter any other thing, any other theory of science. We are not certain. We are just assume it. And as I said, this is because of the experiences of the life. We have to assume it in order to live, because we promise others, because we plan, and for all this. So we assume that the sun will rise tomorrow, but nobody is certain. And if there is such a certainty, it is only an inductive certainty, which is not a real certainty.
More questions?
I'll try. I'm sort of still formulating it, but I'll try. You mentioned earlier something about the root of assassin. Is that the word you were speaking of?
Yeah, assassin.
And last week at the end of the lecture, I asked you a question about passivity, and your response was you have to be very careful. So I'll try to be very careful in not saying this question before I actually have it formed. But when it comes to the following, I have a story that I heard once about the root of assassin and where it came from. And it was a little different than the one that you told. But where is that relationship between love and passivity and following and action in love when it comes to following or acting? Rumi would sort of guide us through his work to do.
But you didn't tell us your story of assassins.
Oh, okay, my friend Buddha told me this, so. I'm on the spot here. That there was these soldiers that were put to sleep or drugged, and were sort of followers of someone, and while they were drugged, they were dragged to this nirvana place where they were surrounded sort of in a harem situation, and that they were told in this environment that they were dead and that this is heaven and this is their reward for martyrdom, so you must go and kill now. And then they were put back in their original environment and woke up and therefore believed that if they followed the code of the assassin, and they would go to heaven or receive this nirvana, and basically it was a trick.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of myths about these assassins, because after all, they were a secret sect, you see, and because of this, there have been a lot of, as I said, myths about their life and their style of behavior and their political activities and their assassinations, which they actually made those assassinations. You know, for example, Nizam al-Mulk, which is one of the greatest viziers in the whole Islamic world of the 4th century, he was assassinated by these people. And even the names of the people who were assassinated are now in books of history. So it is no secret about this particular way and particular action that they did. But how they did it and what was in their mind and how they were trained in order to do it and where from did they bring their courage in order to do it and their camps and so on and so forth. So all these are, very cloudy. We do not know much about them. And because of this cloudiness, as I said, a lot of myth has been written about them. So, you are right. Actually, you can read about them, that they were promised to be rewarded the heavens, or perhaps they were dragged, or as I said, used some grass and so on. And in their state of mind, they thought that they were already in heavens and so on. But they were originally a political sect, of course, based on a particular reading of religion, of Shiism. They were a sect of Shiis. And in one of their main teachings was that the day of resurrection has come. Okay, now we are living as if after our death. Now we are living in the resurrection time. And because of that, all Sharia is over. We are not as Ismailis to observe none of the Sharia rules, to pray, to fast, and all that. So that was, this is documented. This we know about it. And then in terms of the political activities, of course, they were very, very bitterly against the Khilafat of the time. And so they were very decided to assassinate the rulers, the Khalif and the kings and so on and so forth. And as we know, even the Khalif of the time of the 5th century, he had Ghazali to write a lengthy dissertation against this Batinis or Ismailis or the esoteric sect, and he wrote. And of course, he didn't like it later on, but that was what they decided, and they had Ghazali to do it because it was a necessity of the time. So they made these assassinations, but of course, there are some misgivings about the name itself. As I said, since they were called Hashashin, which means the users of the grass. Hashashin is the users of the grass. So in Western vocabulary or rendering, it became assassin, okay? And then the term assassination, murdering and things. But there is another theory about the root and the origin of the name. You see, there were different rankings among the preachers of the so-called assassins. You see, the lowest, I think, was Da'i, which means the simple preacher. And then the highest of them was Asas, which means the foundation. Okay? Now, there is another theory that because of this Asas, which means the foundation, and it is a rank in the preachers of that sect, they were called assassins, means the people who believed in Asas, in the foundation, and they had such a structure and such a hegemony in their ranking of their preachers. So there are two theories altogether, but anyway, this is the famous one, that the word assassin comes from the Hashashin. And of course, the story was very alive at the time of the Rumi. You see, because Rumi was living in the 7th century, and these assassins were very active in 5th century, in 6th century, and even well into the 7th century. So, and the Fatimid rule in Egypt and elsewhere, they were actually the Ismailis or the assassins, if you like. And at the time, Rumi's time was the time of the invasions of Mongols to Iran and many other Islamic countries. And it was only Egypt that was immune from their invasion. And actually, they were actually halted and stopped by the Egyptians and by the Mamluks at the time. So Rumi was living in the Byzantine, the today's Turkey. So he had an eye on the Fatimid rule in Egypt. And since, you know, the Baghdad Khilafat was actually destroyed by the Mongols, Rumi wished the Fatimid rule to flourish, the assassins, according to him. And all this actually comes into what he says and what he actually wishes about the assassins in his poetry. When he says Manjwa Ismail Yonam Bihazar, he actually has in front of his eyes the invasion of the Mughals, the Egypt in which the Fatimid rule was flourishing, and the assassins, i.e., and also, of course, their courage in assassinating, if you like, and in the sacrificing themselves, because their assassination was really a sacrificial, or if you like, a suicidal act. They went, you see, well into the heart of the army of the enemy, you see, and they did what they did very courageously and very cleverly. So for Rumi, it was not the assassination that he liked, but the courage that was associated with it.
How connected do you find Rumi's notion about the perfect entities or the divine traits with the platonic heritage of abstract universes, which are perfect? And
well, no doubt, Rumi was under the influence of Platonic or right, Neo-Platonic ideas. There are, of course, some historians who say that Rumi's conception of a world, of supernatural world and so on, all are colored by Neo-Platonic ideas. Maybe I do not share their ideas, but I cannot avoid actually seeing some of these notions in his in his writings, in his poetry, especially when he says that the whole world is shadow of a super world. So he says this in very clearly, that Murbar Bala Parano Sayash Mitabat Barhat, a bird is flying over our head, and the shadow of the bird is moving on the earth. So the shadow of the bird, which is moving or flying on the earth, is this material, corporeal universe, and the bird itself, of course, is the supernatural entities which live elsewhere. And the shadowiness of the world also, you know, is taken from the story of the cave in Plato and many other places. Islamic mysticism, of course, has got some gives and takes with Neoplatonism. So this is, I think, for sure. And with Buddhism, to some extent, you see. And don't forget that Rumi lived in Afghanistan, in Balkh, where Buddhists were, there. So they had their own temples, and no doubt he himself and his father and others were in contact with them. So they took some ideas from them, and you can actually put your finger sometimes clearly in his books. The world of ideas are like this, and ideas are traveling, and they meet each other, you see, and so Rumi was no exception. But, as I said, I mean, when it comes to love and some other concepts, I think Rumi is very original, and speaks his experience to us. And though it might, be similar to some other ideas elsewhere, but anyway, yes, Neoplatonism played a role in Islamic mysticism, no doubt, even in Islamic philosophy.
In what way? I missed your first lecture. I'm not sure whether you explained about how Shams was an inspiration to Rumi, or are you going to talk about that in your later session?
No, I'm not going to talk about it again. And yes, I mentioned very briefly that Shams was an inspiration to Rumi, and of course it is a mysterious inspiration. We do not know much about it, and Rumi does not tell us much about it, you see. He only mentions Shams in passing, and he deliberately avoids mentioning Shams, and he said that this will create turmoil and things like that, so he avoids that. And sometimes he even says that do not seek bloodshed, because he knew that mentioning Shams and bringing up his name even might create bloodshed and turmoil and things like that. So he avoided it, though he concealed it in his heart actually. And everywhere Shams was with him, he himself actually explains that his relationship with Shams is like he was a thought among other thoughts of Shams. He was a particular thought in the mind of Shams, so he was so close to him. In another place he said that Chanazdikas Jonah to be Jonah, our souls are so close to each other that whatever you think, I think. Whatever I think, you think. So as if we are the same soul, the same personality, the same spirit, and so on. So these are the sort of things that he tells us. And then the oath that I mentioned in the body of lecture, where he says, this is exactly about the outcome of his meeting with Shams. So I was dead, now I'm alive. I was perishable, as I said, now I'm eternal. And then he goes on to mention, actually a dialogue, he mentions that he said, but he never says who said to him, but we know and we can guess that he said means Shams said to me, that you are an imam, you are a leader, so you have to leave all that behind. And then he said that I said to him, yes, I will do all this. So actually what he did was to get rid of all these attachments and belongings and everything, you see. So he became naked, so to speak, according to him. And then he gave him a garment. That is exactly what he says, a kingly garment, according to him. So he became a king, he became courageous, he became... The main gift that was offered to him by Shams was the gift of love, no doubt about it. And this courage and this love gave him the courage, actually, to, as I said, to detach himself from all his attachments. To be a leader, to be a mufti, to be an orator, to be a popular person among your followers, this is not a simple thing actually, to detach yourself from all this and to become naked according to it. But he did all this. He was in his 40s, so he was a well-established person in his community, but he got the courage to do all this. That was the main lesson taught to him by Shams.
Why was Shams?
He didn't calculate
so
about it.
Why was Shams, after all, killed and so?
No, he was not killed. No. It is a myth. He was not killed. Of course, he was teased, if you like, and by the followers of Rumi, because they did not like Shams. They thought that Shams has taken away their master from them. So they did not like Shams, and so. There was a sort of hostility between them. Even one of the sons of Rumi did not like Shams himself. Well, stories tell us that, again, a woman was involved here. Because, the stepdaughter of Rumi, not his real stepdaughter of Rumi, Rumi married her to Shams. And the stories tell us that the son of Rumi actually was in love with the girl. So that was the reason behind the hostility between at least the son of Rumi with Shams. But that was not the whole story, of course. All the followers and the people in the town actually, they did not like Shams because they thought that their mentor, their master, their teacher became altogether very different under him. So Shams fled actually the town, and for the first time, and then he came back, but for the second time he disappeared and never came back. So
one last question. Yeah.
You mentioned that Rumi said that humility is a characteristic of love. That love is boundless kindness. That only God is without bounds, so therefore God is the real true lover. By inference, that must mean that God exhibits humility. So we read and hear about in most major religions about God's, the wrath of God and the reward of God and God's forgiveness. So where and how would we say
we see God's humility?
Well, of course, I mean, there are characteristics which we usually normally do not use for God. I don't see anything wrong with using the word humility, and wrath and other things does not contradict with humility necessarily. I mean, the mercy of God, of course, is the supreme attribute of God. According to people like Rumi, his wrath, his anger, if you like, all are subordinate to his mercy, are manifestations of his mercy, according to this. I can refer you to the book 2 of Masnavi, the story of the Iblis and Muawiyah. You see, there you will see that the Iblis mentions very extensively and in detail to Muawiyah how he became an Iblis. He was an angel and he was beloved by God and he was very close to him and he was worshipping him for thousands of years. And then because of a piece of disobedience, okay, he became an Iblis and actually God rejected him and so on. There, the dialogue between the Muawiyah and the Iblis, of course, is made by Rumi himself. The story you wouldn't find in any source at all. It is Rumi's. There you will see and you will find that the Iblis says, okay, though I am now under the wrath of God, but isn't it the case that the wrath of God is one of the manifestations of his mercy? Therefore, in a hidden way, in a surreptitious way, if you like, I am under the mercy of God, though apparently and ostensibly I am under the wrath of God. So there is a theory, because, you know, there is a hierarchy of attributes of God. The mercy is the highest, and then comes other attributes. And the lower attributes are manifestations of the higher attributes. So this is a piece of theology and a piece of mysticism as well. So the mercy is the highest, is the supreme attribute. And the wrath of God is the one of the lower ones, and that is one of the manifestations of the mercy. Because God is merciful, sometimes he shows wrath to people. It is not because of the wrath itself, it is because of the mercy. Even they say that the hell and the heavens are no different from each other. Both are manifestations of the mercy of God. God is merciful everywhere. It is not the case that sometimes merciful, sometimes not merciful, sometimes generous and sometimes not generous. That is not the case. He's generous all the time and everywhere. He's merciful all the time and everywhere. And because he has got mercy upon his creatures, he has created both heavens and hell. Rumi has got very, very nice descriptions, explanation about the creation of hell. He says some people go to hell and there they actually start knowing and recognizing their God. Some other people, and recognition of God is heaven itself. And there is a tradition in Islam that there comes a day that on the ground of the hell the vegetables will grow. And they say that this means that the hell is part of the heavens. So, I mean, this match for this. Therefore, I mean, there is no contradiction between the two. God having wrath and God having mercy, or the humility of God. But of course, humility is a word which we specifically use for human beings. But in the case of God, this does not mean that he is arrogant. Because arrogance means to claim something which is not yours. If he claims power, if he claims knowledge, this is what he has got. So this is no arrogance on the part of God. But in the case of a lover, according to Rumi, we are borrowers of everything. We are not owners of anything. If we are alive, life is something which has we borrowed it from God. If we are powerful, if we are knowledgeable, if we are this and that, all these are what we have borrowed it from God. So we cannot claim to be owners of this. If we have got an existence at all, this existence is not ours, it's somebody else's, i.e. God. So if we claim existence, I mean independent existence, if we claim knowledge, all these are arrogance and uncomely to us. But for God, if he claims to be omniscient, omnipotent, and so on and so forth, that is no arrogance at all.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. If you have further questions, feel free to come up and speak with Professor Sarush afterwards. One note, next week we'll be back in the Sperry Room, and the start time will be 8 p.m., not 7:30. So next week, 8 p.m. Thank you very much.